lying beside the strange old lady in this burlesque of a life I endure. If only the cowardice would abate for the time needed to reach over and pick up the cocked and loaded pistol that lies on my bedside table. Then I might finally end this facade once and for all. But alas, the cowardice takes no breaks. It is what defines me. It is what frames my life. It is what I am. And yet I cannot resign myself to my own life. Instead, despair is my constant companion as I walk here and then there, without dreams, without hope, and without love. Moth, says the podiatrist, your tale has moved me, and it is clear you need help, but it is help I cannot provide. You must see a psychiatrist and tell him of your troubles. Why on earth did you come to my office? The moth says, because the light was on. By the end of the joke, everyone around was laughing hard, and I started laughing too in spite of myself. But then I got angry because I realized that he was making me look small. So I took a swing at him, but I missed by a good foot or so and ended up knocking over an old man who was pushing some futuristic contraption that rolled on wheels and was attached to his right arm by a thin tube. I bent down to apologize because I felt the accident was partially my fault, and that's when the doctor kicked me heavy in the ribs. I can mend them, but I can bust them up too, he said, and that got another big laugh. Everybody thinks they're a comedian, especially in my line of work. I lay there gasping as the doctor recounted a few hilarious anecdotes, and once the laughing crowd dispersed, he started telling me about the boy I was visiting and his illness. He used a lot of big words. He was still clearly determined to make me look small, so I interrupted him. Okay, okay, I get the idea, Doc. You went to school. I only got one question for you. This thing he's got, is it contagious? No, it's not contagious, he said softly. He looked me in the eye and shook his head at me, all sad and weary. He's just a poor, brave child who hasn't got much time. I noticed a tear as it made its way down his cheek. He wasn't such a tough guy anymore, or so funny either. That's what separates professional funny men like me from bums like that doctor. I crashed into the boy's room with a big smile on my face. Around his bed, nurses and orderlies and a couple of doctors gathered, and they all held clipboards and looked solemn. Death is a funny thing. Not funny ha-ha like a Woody Allen movie, but funny strange, like a Woody Allen marriage. When it's unexpected, death comes fast, like a ravenous wolf, and tears open your throat with a merciful fury. But when it's expected, it comes slow and patient, like a snake, and the doctor tells you how far away it is, and when exactly it will be at your door, and when it will be at the foot of your bed, and when it will be on your flesh. It's all right there, on their clipboards. The room was filled with all kinds of whirring and beeping and dinging. Would somebody turn that doggone noise down, I shouted. Of course, I knew those noises were coming from machines they were using to keep the boy alive, but I also knew I had to make a big entrance, and I didn't want to disappoint. Only the boy laughed, which was fine with me, because he was the most important one there, besides me. I told everybody to scram, so I could have a word with the boy alone. How you feeling, son? How do you think I'm feeling, Einstein? I was genuinely touched that the boy knew I was considered a genius at Saturday Night Live. He had clearly done his research. But his comment also reminded me I had to get back to Rockefeller Center and convince Lauren to put my answering machine sketch on the air that week. Well, see you later, kid. Just wanted to let you know I'm happy to make your wish come true Do you swear to God you'll make my wish come true, Norm? Oh, I don't think that would be such a good idea. Look at me, Norm. I couldn't help but comply, and as I looked at the boy, a curious tenderness overtook me. I swear to God. Good, the boy said, because I have a very different wish. Please don't tell me I have to take you to the show for 2 days. I don't want to go to the show at all. It hasn't been funny since Bill Murray left. Well, why did you choose me then? Because you are a Canadian citizen. I was confused. Son, I do not understand. What's your wish? And what does anything have to do with me being Canadian? The boy looked at me directly, and I could see the tears fill his eyes. He spoke softly, his voice quavering and unsteady. I want to kill a baby seal. Chapter 24, Heading North. This sketch is going to be big, Lauren, real big. Comedy is about what people relate to, and everybody has an answering machine. My God, did you even read it? Yes, I read it, Norm, but it's hardly a sketch. First of all, the host is barely in it. Sandler and Farley have no lines at all. As far as I can tell, it's just you talking about how you don't answer your phone anymore, and how later you tell the person who phoned that you never got the message, and that they must have left it on someone else's answering machine. Then Sandler and Farley laugh for an uncomfortably long time. Right. They laugh for a long time because what I'm saying is really funny. Well, wouldn't it be a better idea to let the audience decide whether it's really funny? With all due respect, Lorne, I think that would be the worst thing we could possibly do. Believe me, I've been down that road before. The answer is no, Norm. Look, there's only a couple of shows left in the season, and if I don't get a sketch on air, I'm worried for my job. Well, you should be, said Lorne. And then it hit me. He'd found out. Lorne Michaels was well-connected in this town, and someone must have tipped him off. So, I'm being punished for making some kid's final wish come true, is that it? Listen, Lorne, it wasn't my idea. It was some lady who phoned me. I'll phone her back right now and tell her it's not a good week, because of the answering machine sketch. Lorne's eyes turn misty, like a woman's sometimes do. No, 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 Norm. I think you should fulfill this boy's wish. And don't worry. I'll make sure we get your sketch on air. But it needs a massive rewrite. Work on it with Fred Wolf. Lauren smiled at me and shook my hand. I'm proud of you, Norm. You're doing a fine thing. And with that, his eyes turned misty again. He was an odd duck, Lauren Michaels, no doubt about it. I put Adam Egott on a plane to Gander, Newfoundland, while I hunkered down with Fred Wolf to work on the answering machine sketch. Fred was a writer of the highest order, whom I had known for years from our stand-up days. I loved Fred's outright disdain for certain hosts. Many times, SNL would have a very handsome, dramatic actor on as a host, an actor who was convinced he was funny. Women are attracted to funny men, it is often said. This is not true. It only appears this way because women laugh at everything a very handsome man says. So, this gives the very handsome men the idea that they are funny. This phenomenon made Fred angry, and he refused to refer to the handsome hosts by name. Instead, he would call them Face. Hey, Norm, he'd say and point to his script. You think Face will be able to handle this line? That would always make me bust a gut. Face. Perfect. Fred was a pro and very patient. And he convinced me that we should have a phone and an answering machine on the set to add verisimilitude to the sketch. We almost got to blows over that point because I was afraid the devices would draw focus away from me and the jokes I'd been perfecting for years. I'd done the bit on stage over 5,000 times to mixed results without ever using a phone or an answering machine prop. But Fred and I finally reached a compromise. The phone and answering machine would appear in the sketch, and in return, we wouldn't come to blows. We both knew Fred Wolf could beat the living bejesus out of me. Cheryl, the receptionist, stuck her head in the office door. Phone call from your assistant, Adam Egott. Say, Cheryl, how come when you say the word assistant, you use a tone to make it sound as if Adam Egott is not my assistant at all, but something different? Something unseemly. Why is it when you say the word you make air quotes with your fingers? I asked. Well, I mean, he is your assistant, isn't he? I mean, his job is to assist you, so that would make him your assistant, wouldn't it? No, Cheryl. Adam Egan is not my assistant at all. He's my assistant. He assists me all the time. He's never once assisted me. You can ask Fred. I thought he was your assistant too, Norma. I think everyone does. Fred, are you telling me that everybody thinks Adam Egan, my assistant, is actually my assistant? And that he doesn't assist me at all? That what he really does is assist me? Yes. He's on line one, Norm. And with that, Cheryl left. Adam Egan here, Norm. I found a guy. We can be in and out of here in 3 days. If it all works out, we'll have you back Saturday afternoon, just in time for dress rehearsal. On my way, I said, and hung up. Chapter 25, A Wish Fulfilled. As per our plan, the boy informed his parents, who then informed me, that the boy had decided he might like to spend the entire week at SNL, so he could see how a sketch goes from an idea on paper all the way to a sketch on live television. Yeah, me and him both. I agreed, and 2 hours later, we were both on a prop plane to Gander, Newfoundland. Edward McClintock was a cod fisherman from up Labrador way. Edward's father, and his father's father, and his father's father's father had all been sealers. Edward was not a sealer, but he killed seals. The seal and I make our living the same way, cod. One seal can eat 300 to 400 North Atlantic cod a day, and those are cod I can't catch. Do you follow? Yes, sir, I said. They sound like gluttonous beasts, these seals. I mean, I like a nice piece of cod as much as the next guy, but 300 to 400, well, that's just eating to eat. Speaking of gluttonous beasts, son, your friend has been eating me out of house and home. And he can't hold his drink. I have no use for a man who can't hold his drink. And he motioned toward Adam Egan, who was inert under a quilt beside the fireplace. He handed me his bottle of iceberg rum, and I took a swig of it and felt nice and warm inside. He can be trusted, sir, I said. He always does what he's told. Fair enough. We'll sit right here and we'll drink till dawn while I tell you what we have to do to kill a seal. Then in the morning we'll make our way to the floes. But honestly, I think it's a mistake. I can see that bye, and he looks frail. This is going to be a rugged sojourn, and the bye is pale and his eyes are dim. The boy is in perfect health, I said. And so, as Adam Egan and the boy slept and dreamt, Edward McClintock and I talked into the night, as men will do, and we were warmed by the fireplace and the iceberg rum. Finally, dawn came and the boy woke up. He was ghastly pale, and Edward McClintock remarked upon it. But when the boy spoke, his enthusiasm for what lay ahead made him appear to be of sound body. He wanted to hear all about the coming adventure, and Edward McClintock said he would tell us soon, but didn't want to repeat anything. Then he got up from his chair, walked to the fireplace, and with his heavy boot, he kicked Adam Egan awake. We sat around the kitchen table as Edward McClintock poured us coffee and warned us about the North Atlantic Ocean. I first traveled this strip of sea as a child on a dare in a small Rodney made for jigging squid, and by luck I survived. But in my youthful pride I took my survival as a sign of providence, and instead of kneeling in thanks, I stood tall in vainglory. Well, since then this sea has battered me and froze me. I've lost 4 toes and a finger, and I've been swept under 12 times. The North Atlantic Ocean, she don't care about you and me and whether we live or die. You remember that, boys, and show her the respect she's earned.
Are you going to make those flapjacks today, Eddie? Adam Egan asked.
What? Edward McClintock snapped.
Those flapjacks sure are good, Eddie. I could eat those forever.
I saw fire in Edward McClintock's cobalt blue eyes, and I was afraid for Adam Egan, but Edward held himself still until the fire went out. Yes, he said, we'll breakfast big this morning. For the next 3 days we'll be living on herring and rum. We ate a great large meal, and I felt fat and fine. Then Edward McClintock took us to the boat, and we were off to make a young boy's final wish come true. As I looked at the boy, I noticed he was already shivering under his hides, and Edward McClintock had warned us that it would only get colder. I was scared. If the boy didn't live, it was going to look bad for me. Real bad. 6 hours in, the boy developed a fever. Edward McClintock was very concerned and thought we should turn back, but the boy insisted he would be fine. "Yes, he'll be fine," I said, and gave him his pills. There were so many pills. I let him wash them down with the iceberg rum. As we waited to spot a seal, I played a game with the boy. We would look up at the white clouds above and find figures in them. "That one looks like a bird," I said. "Yeah, it does. And look at that one. It looks like a man rubbing his nose," he returned. "I don't see it." "You see the bottom of it? That's the man's chin, and then his mouth is wide open." And then I saw it. And we played this game for 2 days, and we saw alligators and pickles and trees and every sort of thing, all of them white and still and living in the cold and limitless sky. In the middle of the second day, we heard the cries of seals. The boy jumped up, then coughed an awful rattle of a cough, and fell back down. We were all pretty well frozen, and I looked over at Adam Egget, whose tears had become ice halfway down his cheek. Edward McClintock pulled the boat up and threw out a rope, and then took a hammer and smashed a spike into the 3-foot thick ice and anchored us to the berg. The ice had snow on top, so it wasn't slippery, and up ahead we could see men and hear their gunshots. "Damn punks from St. John's with their pistols. That's not how you kill a seal." He took a rucksack from the boat and pulled out a crude ancient weapon. It had a wooden handle and a curved blade at one end. It looked like a cross between a scythe and a bayonet. "This is a hackapick, son. The baby harp, she has a skull as thin as a shadow, and it takes just one blow to fell her. But your strike must find the forehead. Then her eyes will open and be glassy. When you touch the eyes, if they don't move, the beast is dead. Do you follow?" "Yes, sir," the boy said, and smiled broadly. But then he coughed, that awful, empty cough. We had about 100 yards between the seal and us, but they were some of the longest yards I've ever traversed. I had to carry the boy toward the seal. There was a wind, and it howled like a hammer, and I could no longer hear the whimpers of Adam Egget, who slipped and fell every few feet. I hadn't walked for the last 2 days, and my legs weren't working properly. It was as if I had to learn it new, like a foal, and on snow and ice. I knew I couldn't fall for the sake of the boy, so I walked slow, stopped to put the boy down and rest every few minutes, and then I began walking again. We'd only walked about 50 yards when a great weariness settled on me, and I didn't think I could go farther. Suddenly, all I wanted to do was sleep. But Edward McClintock had warned me that the cold will trick a man, and that sleep that sweetly beckons is not really sleep at all, but the deeper thing. So I forced my eyes wide and looked ahead where I saw Edward McClintock, about 30 yards beyond us, standing still as a rabbit. He turned and fastened his malamute eyes on me, and his voice was clock-steady as the frozen words came from his cracked lips. "Baby harp." Knowing the creature was only some 50 yards from where I stood gave me the strength to continue. I put the boy down gently like a kitten, and Edward McClintock handed him the hackapick. "Are you sure you can swing it, son, or should I help?" he asked. But the boy was already on his way, and soon he was standing above the baby seal. We watched, the three of us, while the boy mustered all his strength to swing the hackapick high in the air, then downward and fast, and the seal's thin skull exploded, and a spray of blood fell around and upon the boy. The boy swung again and again until he was awash with the delight of blood, and he was a figure of bright red with the everlasting white behind him. It was as if the creature's very life had somehow leaped into the boy, and the three of us were silent in the witness of this wicked miracle. The boy danced about energetically, singing, while Edward McClintock skinned the seal. Then we returned, and the day was as cold as iron. None of us spoke, but for the boy, who chatted gaily and sang. When I gave him his pills, he laughed and threw them into the North Atlantic Ocean. I made it back to Rockefeller Center at 11:15 p.m. and raced backstage. The rundown was on the wall. Beside answering machine sketch, it read, "Cut after dress." I went to my dressing room, locked the door, and cried. No one but the four of us ever knew of the journey. The boy made a complete recovery and was written up in several medical journals. Everyone agreed that his survival defied worldly explanation. The boy attained a small measure of fame, and was even invited to Gracie Mansion, where he met the mayor himself. It was barely reported a year later when, while crossing Fifth Avenue, he was struck by a New York City bus and killed instantly.
I cannot find Norm's essence. It is a problem I've never encountered as a ghost, and I need to truly become him to finish the book. It has always been my great gift, the ability to find a person's essence. But Norm evades me. It must be because I hate him with such intensity. That simply cannot continue. This will be the last book I ever ghostwrite, and I need it to be a fine book. You see, I have a secret, a splendid secret that has kept me going for many years. All the time I have been writing the lives of peripheral celebrities, I have been writing something else as well. It is a novel. The tale of a brilliant painter, a master of surreal involution whose work goes unrecognized by the New York art scene, and so our hero must make his living as a house painter. He becomes known as an excellent house painter, and he makes a fine living from his pedestrian work and nothing from his brash genius. One day, the great artist is commissioned to paint a house. The owner of the house will be gone for a month, and this gives the artist a notion. He decides he will use the house as his canvas, and so begins my novel, The House Painter. And I have finally completed it. In front of me, on my desk, lies the manuscript for The House Painter, beside the half-finished, based on a true story, like gold beside sand.
Chapter 26, Tiny White Coffin. It sure was tragic what happened to that boy, Norm, Adam Egott says, with a weighty expression that brings everything back to me like it was yesterday. The boy had turned 10 years old only a few days before the accident, and now he lay in Strickland's funeral home in a tiny white coffin. When all the strangers had finished looking at him and sadly shaking their heads so that all present knew their feelings on the matter, his mother was left alone in the room with the tiny white coffin, alone but for me. I lingered behind, unseen, while the funeral director shooed the others into a room with a sad-faced pastor who was preparing to speak. The mother stood and looked down into the tiny white coffin. Her posture, which had been rigid all morning, went slack at the shoulders and neck. Her hands remained clasped tightly in front of her. The boy was wearing a navy blue suit with a white shirt and a tie, but he still did not look like a man. I stayed quiet in the shadows so as not to disturb the moment. After a time had passed, the funeral director opened the door and quietly let the mother know that her time was up. As she turned to leave, she looked one last time into the tiny white coffin, and then she did a strange thing. A thing I will never forget. She straightened the knot in the boy's tie, and looked to make sure it was right. I took in a fast, jagged gulp of air and slunk into the next room before she noticed me. There were cookies and an urn of coffee on a table in the other room. The cookies were awful. None of the cookies contained jelly in the middle, which are widely considered the best funeral home cookies. There were only dry shortbreads left. The coffee was black, and there was no cream or milk, just packets of white-yellow powder. When I poured the powder into the styrofoam cup of black bitter coffee, it just sat in a pile on the top. When I mixed the powder in with a black plastic stick, the coffee turned gray like dishwater. It got me pretty steamed, and I'm sure the rest of the people who had gathered felt the same way. We all went into the adjoining room and took our seats. The tiny white coffin had been placed in the front of the room, and the sad-faced pastor was standing beside it. The sad-faced pastor told us how the boy had not been an ordinary boy. He had been very special. He had been a brother and a son and a grandson and even a great-grandson. I looked over and saw them sitting there, the young and the old and the older and the oldest. The sad-faced pastor told us that some things were very mysterious, but that there was a meaning behind everything, even something as tragic as this. He then asked if anyone had anything they would like to say, and people came up one at a time to speak about the boy. I decided to go up and speak too, since I had experience in public speaking. Of course, I wasn't about to do my stand-up. That would be ridiculous. I pulled out the piece of paper with a speech I'd prepared, and then, when I was about to read it, I suddenly changed my mind. "Folks, I have in my hand here a speech I wrote that's full of big, fancy words, but I'm not going to read it." And I crumpled up my speech and threw it to the floor with contempt. "You don't want to hear a bunch of fancy words, many of them so fancy you wouldn't even understand them. Instead, I will speak from the heart. I have never done such a thing before, but I hear it can be quite effective. Ladies and gentlemen, bereaved relatives, youngsters who have lost a brother or a sister or a friend, the guy in the sad-faced pastor costume, the lady sitting beside him, I figure it's his wife, and finally, of course, the guy hanging around at the door wearing a Carolina Panthers jacket, who is clearly in the wrong room but has the grace to hang in here till the end. I thank you all for coming." I was proud to have known this boy, and I was proud that his last wish in life was to see me do a sketch on the Saturday Night Live program. Although I cannot say I was all that surprised. I'm a very good sketch player. But this is not about me. I really shouldn't be making it about me. But this is the first time I have ever spoken from the heart, so I beg your indulgence. I feel this speech will really start to get good very soon. But it didn't. And I realized something during the next 20 minutes, as my speech moved from one inane anecdote to another, none of them having to do with the boy. What I realized then was that some guys are very good at speaking from the heart, and some guys just are not. Doesn't mean one guy's better than the other, just different. So I was honest with the people. "Ladies and gentlemen, I apologize for this speech. For the last 5 or 6 minutes, I've been telling you about Gordie Howe. And I think we all know what an awful, awful mistake me speaking from the heart was. So, if I may ask your help, let's try to find that speech with the big fancy words that I threw away some minutes ago. It's got to be around here somewhere." "Here it is," a sweet old lady near the front said. "I read it and thought it was very good, especially the part about how we can learn more from the children than they can learn from us." "Oh, excellent. I'm glad you liked that part, because it's the surprise ending." So that's shot. Now I guess I'll just have to read it without the surprise ending. And there appears to be coffee spilled all over it. "Oh, yes," the sweet old lady said. "I spilled coffee all over the darn thing." "Okay, well, I can't make out any of the big fancy words now at all. But that's nobody's fault. I mean, in fairness, part of it is my fault for crumpling it up and tossing it away so cavalierly. You know, I think cavalierly may have been one of the big fancy words in my speech. Also, it's partly the sweet old lady's fault for spilling so much coffee on the paper that not a single word can be made out. But we're not here to place blame. I will say this about the young boy in the tiny white coffin. Despite the doctor's dire predictions, the boy was too tough, resolute, and courageous to let something as small as a deadly disease defeat him. No, the boy was made of stronger stuff than that, and it took much more to defeat him. It took a 3-ton municipal bus moving at 40 miles per hour and driven by one Cecil Richard Anderson to defeat this boy. I heard the deepest of sobs and looked down to see a man wearing some sort of bus driver's uniform being held up by two women. If you cry, sir, then cry with envy and not pity, for the boy is in the clouds, and he is one with the clouds. It is we who are left who are reminded on this unacceptable day that life is swift, and yet we are blind to its mighty splendor, which can be found in the simplest of things. Things like a walk in the park, a conversation with a good friend, a deep, rich coffee, leavened with half cream and half milk, and served in a sturdy mug, one with some heft, and with it a delicious cookie that's white and has red jelly in the middle. Thank you for listening, and due to the solemnity of the occasion, I would ask you to hold your applause. From there, we all went to the graveyard. The day was bright and clean, and the cool autumn air filled my lungs and made me feel healthy. A time passed, and then the hearse showed up. The pallbearers were all big men, and they carried the tiny white coffin as if it was very heavy, although it could not have weighed more than 80 or 90 pounds. There was a small hole in the ground and some dirt beside it. We stood in a circle, and the sad-faced pastor said some things in Latin, and then we formed a line. The sun was directly overhead and made the tiny white coffin ever so bright, and I took a handful of dirt and flung it down on top. Then it was the next guy's turn. Afterward, I walked back, alone, down a long blacktop road, and it was cold. And in the sky there were white clouds, and they all looked like white clouds, and nothing else. Chapter 27, Leaving Las Vegas. Gabe walks into the hotel room. He is much less surprised by my presence than Adam, and much less overcome by emotion as well. Chickened out, huh, Norm? That'll cost me a pretty penny. I don't blame you, though. He didn't chicken out, Gabe. He's only alive by mistake. Gabe looks relieved. You won't get any more credit in Vegas, Norm. You're done until you pay off at least one hotel. The good news is these are businessmen. They aren't going to harm you. They'll be patient. But when they turn the debt over to collection agencies, well, those boys can make your life hell. And eventually, you might be facing prison time. But you can cut a deal with the casinos and get on a monthly payment plan. These are reasonable men. They don't expect all the money back. They just want as much as they can get. Gabe, no disrespect, but I don't give a good goddamn about all that. I'm looking to own a ranch in Montana, to be a god among men. And I've been thinking, and I beat the devil once, I can beat some Vegas debt collectors. Hey, you wouldn't happen to have any more dilaudid on you, would you? Gabe just looks at me. Like every man who's ever lived, Gabe, I spent my life searching for happiness. And after I'd lost it all, and after I'd laid down in a bed and let go of my life, I arose from that bed, and I envisioned happiness, real happiness. It involves living deep in Montana. It'll be expensive, and I know I'm in debt, but I can win the money. I know I can. I just need someone to stake me. How much? I need $1 million. I can win enough with that to pay off my debts and live a good and happy life. There's only one man who can help you with that problem. He used to be a bookie out of Galveston, but now he lives in a palace that overlooks the Salton Sea, and he loans people money, any amount of money. I can't believe what I'm hearing. I've heard the stories about the fat man with the artificial hair for years, just like everybody else, but they always seemed like myths. And I know all about the Salton Sea. It is a geographic wonder, a real-life lake shimmering in the middle of the desert, and that's something even Las Vegas doesn't have. It was what was supposed to bring in tourists from everywhere, promising water and desert in the very same place. They began building resorts where guests could fish and water ski and gamble and golf. At the time, it seemed like a no-brainer, and the investors flooded in. But in the end, it was a bust, and everyone left. But was it possible that one man stayed? A man with a mansion on the barren Salton Sea, who lent out huge sums of money. But if anyone dared not repay him, he exacted the ultimate price. It's true the fat man with the artificial hair had disappeared from Texas at about the same time that the men with money flocked to the Salton Sea. Was it possible he'd stayed behind? That he still believed? And now here was Gabe, telling me it was true. Gabe, you're not telling me you believe the fat man with the artificial hair actually exists, are you? Oh, he's real, all right. I know a guy who used to be a dealer at the Bellagio, and now he makes $1,000 a day standing near the fat man with the artificial hair holding a machine gun. If you say he's real, Gabe, then that's good enough for me. I'll go and find this man, and I'll make my second deal with the devil. Get the challenger, Adam Egget. I'll be out in a minute. When we are alone, Gabe gives me a serious look. Keep your wits about you with the fat man with the artificial hair. If you offend him, he'll kill you and throw you into the sea. Where you're going now, there is no law. Someone will be guarding the mansion. In order to gain entry, you must say, I am a desperate man, here to ask a favor. I'll remember that, Gabe, and I'll be careful. Minutes later, Adam Egget and I are moving so fast, it feels like the challenger is rolling down the steepest hill. I open the window and put my head out, with my mouth wide open, and my tongue licks up the wind. I am as happy as a dog. Adam Egget, we have very little money, and it has to last until we reach the Salton Sea. Don't worry about it. If we need money, that's what liquor stores are for. No, that's not what they're for, Adam Egget. They're for selling liquor. No can do. One day at a time, right? Yeah. Whatever. I'll need your gun. Adam Egget looks hurt, and I understand. I've never taken a man's gun from him, but Gabe had warned me about the dangerous place we are driving to, and I don't want Adam Egget deciding he's a man all of a sudden. He hands it over. The challenger screeches to a stop. Look, Norm, this has been fun, but please let me go home now. I miss the comedy store. I miss Polly. I miss my job and being a boss. I've been thinking, and I did everything you asked of me when you told me about the plan at Whiskey Pete's. Well, things have changed since then, Adam Egget. He looks at me steady. Yes, things have changed. I've fallen in love, and now I'm afraid of where we're going and what we're doing. Please, Norm, I've done everything you asked. I remember another time you were afraid for your life, I say. And you were right to be afraid. But you are alive today because I saved you. Don't you remember the night of the gypsy? Perhaps it's been too many years. Perhaps you've forgotten. I remember, Norm, but I can't keep paying for that for the rest of my life. What happens after all this is over? Well, Adam Egget, then we will be all square, you and I. You will be a free man. Adam Egget smiles. All you have to do until then is survive. His smile vanishes, and the challenger resumes its journey as we move fast toward the Salton Sea. Chapter 28, Weekend Update. Hey, Norm, how'd you get Weekend Update? I'm out of cigarettes, so I pour a few grains of liquid morphine into a glass pipe. I use a torch lighter that sends an obelisk of hard blue fire to attack the glass, and make the morphine sizzle and spit like bacon grease. My mind begins a crazy dance. Well, let me think, Adam Egget. Let me think. There was only a week until my second season on SNL began. I was out of prison and had my immortal soul intact. Sarah had just announced she would be leaving the show. She said she could no longer live in New York, that she was being tormented day and night by some obsessive stalker. This caught me completely by surprise, as I had taken to hanging around Sarah's apartment, hiding in the bushes day and night, watching her come and go, and I had never seen any signs of a stalker. But she was gone now, and I had to turn my attention to my future at SNL. The problem was, Lauren still had no idea what to do with me. The two of us had been partying pretty heavy for 3 days straight down at the Chelsea Hotel, but we had been discussing a serious matter as well. What would my role on SNL be next season? "You can't write," said Lauren. "You can't act or do characters. I simply don't know how we can use you." There was a lot of truth in what Lauren said, but it still hurt. I knew I could write, because I had been doing stand-up for years and had plenty of surefire bits that would make for dynamite sketches. And I knew I could appear in those sketches, because I performed those stand-up bits thousands of times to wildly mixed reactions. I told Lauren as much. He looked at me long, and his eyes were tranquil and pale. "Norm, the thing is, you're not really suited for the show. You're more suited to touring the country, playing smaller and smaller clubs until you finally fizzle into oblivion and are given an unattended pauper's funeral," he said. There was a lot of truth in what Lauren said, but it still hurt. Suddenly, I saw a light bulb go on over Lauren's head, and his eyes brightened, and I could tell he had an idea. But no such luck. It was just that goddamn bare light bulb that hung from the ceiling and kept going on and off all day. Finally, as usual in creative matters, it was the drugs that thought up the idea. After Lauren had injected himself with a near-fatal dose of the opioid, his eyes rolled back in his head, then returned to where a fellow's eyes usually rest. "Let me ask you a question, Norm, and I want you to be completely honest with me." "Of course I'll be honest, Lauren." "Fat chance." "If we let you sit down on a chair behind a desk, and we stick giant cue cards 2 feet in front of your face, do you think you could read what is on those cue cards?" "Of course, Lauren," I said, "and I won't let you down. I just have one question. Do I get to have a gun?" I always asked this question every time someone had a plan for me, just in case they said yes. Like everyone else, Lauren said no. "Let's celebrate by throwing the TV out the window," I suggested. But now Lauren looked concerned. "I just remembered Al Franken wants the update spot, and he's been lobbying pretty hard for it. The truth is he's much more qualified than you. He's been on the show since its inception, and there's nothing concerning politics or satire that Al is not on intimate terms with. Whereas you're an illiterate nightclub comic." There was a lot of truth in what Lauren said, but it was really starting to get on my nerves. "Look, Lauren, what if I was to tell you that if Al Franken were to step aside and allow me to host Update, I could make him a United States senator?" "How could you possibly make that happen, Norm?" "I know people." I was telling the truth, but only technically. I did know people, more than 24, in fact, but none who could help make a civilian into a senator. It was a huge bluff, but Lauren bought it. In an interesting sidebar, Al Franken, buoyed by the idea that the fix was in for him, ran for office in 2009 and became the junior senator representing Minnesota. He has not been heard from since. "Hey, Lauren, I was thinking the best writer at SNL, Jim Downey, could be head writer of Update," I said, as I tossed a double shot of morphine at his feet. "What do you say?" Jim Downey was the best writer at SNL. He'd been there since the beginning, and only left for a short spell to work on Late Night with David Letterman. He had helped usher into being two of the best and most original comedy shows of his generation. Not bad for a guy with a grade 1 education. I knew that Downey's platinum writing credentials, combined with my ability to read words off giant cue cards that the producers would place 2 feet in front of my face, would be a potent mix. "Well, the thing is, Norm, you are absolutely correct," said Lorne. "Jim is non-perio." Then he just looked at me. A long time passed, maybe 45 minutes, until I finally said, "All right, all right. What's that word mean?" "Oh, it means he is without parallel. He's the best writer we have. We use him to write all the political sketches." "I have a better idea," I said. "He'll work for me. That way the jokes will all be sure fire, and I'll just have to read them." "Sorry, Norm. Jim will write the political sketches. He's much too valuable to only be working on Update. When it comes to the show, Norm, you'll find I don't compromise. SNL always comes first." "I'll give you 3 times as much morphine." Lauren picked up his phone and dialed. "Jim, you're on Update from now on." Thank God for Lorne Michaels and his hopeless addiction to liquid morphine. Chapter 29, The Update Team. The next person I got on the Weekend Update team was Lori Jo Hoekstra, whose talent was being wasted as a writer's assistant. She was always the funniest girl in the room and could keep up with the big boys, even Sandler, who loved her. Her taste in comedy was non-pareil, and I convinced her to be the producer of the segment. I loved Ian Maxtone Graham and wanted him exclusively on Update, but he was too important to the show and would have to split his time between my work and the sketches. He served as a consultant along with Steve Luckner, who always submitted highly eccentric jokes. From the outset, Lauren let me know that I could make Update into anything I wanted it to be, but that I would always have to deliver the jokes, completely unarmed. Lori Jo, Downey, and I discussed it. Before me, the Weekend Update staff had always been made up of just the host and one writer. But that was because the host would write jokes every week. I had a completely different style. I would write roughly 1 to 2 jokes every 2 years and spend most of my time practicing reading giant cue cards 2 feet in front of my face. Lori Jo then suggested we hire outside writers so that Weekend Update would have a completely different flavor from the rest of SNL. She suggested Ross Abrash, a veteran comedy scribe who was the best in the business and the man who taught me what the word scribe means. And Frank Sebastiano, a UPS driver, just like that fat guy on TV with the bitchy wife. Frank had been sending in 200 jokes a week on brown paper bags, just trying to land a job. The jokes were so good that we hired him. The team was in place. I'll never forget our first meeting. Jim Downey explained that Sandler had successfully remade SNL with his rock star persona. He thought we should follow Sandler's lead and develop Weekend Update with a punk sensibility, and cited The Clash as our muse. Everyone in the room agreed with Jim. Everyone but me. "Listen here, Jim. One of the most important qualities for a performer to have is the ability to know his own limitations. I've never been a good singer. I'm the guy in front of the camera, and I'm going to have to nix that one." Jim explained that he meant the show should echo the ethos of punk rock, where everything but the essence of the music was stripped away. It really had nothing to do with singing. But I put my foot down and addressed the whole room. "I got 2 words for all of you, and if you want to keep your jobs, you'll listen. No singing!" Jim just sighed. But I knew I'd been heard. Never once in my 3 years as Update anchor was a singing joke submitted. Lori Jo agreed with Jim that jokes should be stripped of any cleverness, play on words, or innuendo. Jokes should never elicit applause, Lori Jo insisted. A joke should catch people by surprise. It should never pander. Applause is voluntary, but laughter is involuntary. Lori Jo is sure smart, and the whole room agreed. And I pretended to, but my mind was far away on a meeting I had set up for later that afternoon with Wally Ferriston, the cue card guy. No offense to our team, but I knew that Wally and I were the key players. Ian Maxtone Graham spoke next. He said he loved the jokes that Frank Sebastiano was submitting, where the punchlines were preposterously blunt. I also loved those punchlines and said as much. The directness really made me laugh. Ross Abrash wrote short, to-the-point jokes. There was never an ounce of fat in a joke written by Ross. Frank thought of new ways to tell jokes. Don't I know it? Or so the Germans would have us believe. Note to self. Or, as Ted Kennedy calls it, Thursday. Together, they are the most copied joke writers of their generation. Exactly, said Downey. That's what I was getting at when I said the segment should have a punk feel. This time I smashed my hand down hard on the desk. I said no singing, goddammit! Jim sighed again. He was starting to realize that his dream of putting me on set with an electric guitar, singing and spitting on the audience, was not going to fly, so he decided to give up. Steve Luckner had submitted an early joke. Lyle Lovett and Julia Roberts are getting divorced. Insiders say the trouble began because he was Lyle Lovett and she was Julia Roberts. I sure loved that joke. I'd never heard a joke where the premise and the punchline were so close. Exactly, said Downey. That's what I was getting at when I... But I glowered at him and he cast his eyes down. If he wanted to listen to his Sex Pistol records, he could do it at home. But Downey felt he should warn me that the type of comedy we were writing wasn't traditional, and I couldn't expect to get wall-to-wall laughs. This was avant-garde stuff. I didn't tell him at the time, but if not getting laughs was avant-garde, I'd been avant-garde week in and week out in stand-up clubs across the country. Jim told me I had to think up a line to introduce the segment every week. The two best anchors were Dennis Miller, who opened the segment with, I'm Dennis Miller and what can I tell you? And Chevy Chase, who opened with, I'm Chevy Chase and you're not. I suggested, I'm Norm MacDonald and here's a string of jokes. The group initially seemed amused, but ultimately hated it. I said, I'm Norm MacDonald and this is the fake news. No one liked this at all. The news was real, I was told. The newscast itself was fake, but all the news within the segment was real. I disagreed vehemently. Are you telling me that the first parts of these jokes are things that really happened? Yes, said Ross Abrash. We always start with a real story from the news, not a fake one. And then we make up the last part, or the punchline, which is a comment on the first real part, the setup. Well, I say you're a liar. You just make up the first part, and then it's easy to think of a funny second part. No, Ross insisted. I can assure you every setup we do comes from the real news. So saying this is the fake news makes no sense, and it makes you look like an idiot. Well, I guess we'll just have to agree to disagree, I said. No, said Ross. I will not agree to disagree. I will only disagree. I didn't know that was allowed, so I looked around the room. Well, we've heard from Ross. Is anyone here in this room willing to agree to disagree with me? Not a single soul agreed to disagree with me. However, everyone was in solidarity when it came to simply and violently disagreeing with me. Long after I left the segment, the term fake news became the ordinary way to describe what was done on SNL, as well as The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. So who's the idiot now? People often ask how many jokes I contributed to Weekend Update. The answer can be a whole bunch or one, depending on how you look at it. I pitched it during that first meeting. David Hasselhoff is a major recording star in Germany, where his two shows, Baywatch and Knight Rider, are huge hits, which all goes to prove my theory. Germans love David Hasselhoff. No one laughed. Jim said, you can do it, Norm, but non sequiturs have to be done often to have any chance to work. Okay, professor, I sneered. What's a non sequitur? It's a joke that makes no sense. It's structured like a joke, but has no content. Jim was really starting to get on my nerves. That was no non sequitur. It was a real joke. The meeting had held such promise, but it was turning bad quickly, and I sensed that two camps were forming, the camp I was in and the camp everyone else was in. I knew where I was needed. I quickly excused myself and went to meet with Wally Ferriston to discuss the size of the cue cards. The new incarnation of Weekend Update premiered in the fall of 1994 and was an instant hit. The New York Times hailed it punk rock comedy, which is what I had been intending for them to notice from the beginning. Frank and Ross wrote all day, every day, on Update, and by week's end they had generated maybe 2,000 jokes. We'd cut it down to 30 for dress and to about a dozen for air. By that time, the jokes would be bulletproof, exactly like one of those punk rock songs. We also filled the time with features, of course, and it was so fun to have Sandler do his Hanukkah song or Farley do anything at all, really. Later, guys like Jim Brewer and Colin Quinn came along and were perfect for features because they came from stand-up and knew how to perform directly into camera. And I got to sit right beside them and watch. And when the camera wasn't on me, I could swig warm bourbon from a flask. I knew Weekend Update was becoming popular because my influence at the show was beginning to build. I was a natural at reading cue cards that were held 2 feet from my face. I noticed that my power on the show was directly related to the size of the cue cards. I kept demanding larger and larger cue cards until mine were over 4 times as big as any other cast member's. I even negotiated for Wally to get his own personal trainer who would work with him during the week since the weight of the giant cue cards was beginning to prove too much for him. We were having a great time at Weekend Update until the grumbling began. I had heard things, but I just chalked it up to general grumbling. But it was not. It was grumbling that was specific to Weekend Update, and specific to me. But I never worried. Weekend Update was the funniest it had ever been, and when you are that funny, you can be sure that you will not be fired. Chapter 30. Top 25 Weekend Update Jokes of All Time, in no particular order. Number 1. The post office announced today that it is going to issue a stamp commemorating prostitution in the United States. It's a 10-cent stamp, but if you want to lick it, it's a quarter. Chevy Chase. Number 2. At the White House this week, President Clinton officially came out against same-sex marriages. What's more, the president said he's not too crazy about opposite-sex marriages either. Norm MacDonald. Number 3. A new FBI study shows that for the first time, Americans are more likely to be killed by a stranger than by a loved one or acquaintance. Their advice? Introduce yourself to as many people as possible. Norm MacDonald. Number 4. The American Academy of Pediatrics has announced its list of unsafe baby products. Topping the list this year is the really, 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 really high chair. Norm MacDonald. Number 5. Dr. Jack Kevorkian was responsible for another death this week. This time, it was a 58-year-old woman. She's the 26th of Dr. Kevorkian's patients to die since 1990. When are people going to realize this man is not a good doctor? Norm MacDonald. Number 6. The richest girl in the world, billionaire Athena Onassis, celebrated her 10th birthday this week. What's it like to be the richest girl in the world? Well, to give you some idea, at the party, they had 2 cakes. Norm MacDonald. Number 7. A new hangover-free vodka is on the market. The ads claim that the 80-proof vodka is so pure, it's virtually headache-free. But before you run out and buy it, remember, it causes massive anal bleeding. Norm MacDonald. Number 8. Julie Roberts told reporters this week that her marriage to Lyle Lovett has been over for some time. The key moment, she said, came when she realized that she was Julia Roberts and that he was Lyle Lovett.
Norm MacDonald. Number 9. Well, the results are in, and once again, Microsoft CEO Bill Gates is the richest man in America. Gates says he is grateful for his huge financial success, but it still makes him sad when he looks around and sees other people with any money whatsoever. Norm MacDonald. Number 10. This week in the O.J. Simpson trial, Johnny Cochran delivered a spellbinding final summation. In a brilliant move, Cochran put on